You are listening to WGXC. This is Melinda Broughton. I'm sitting in the studio with Isabel Barton.
And she is the filmmaker of The Making of the Chief, a film that just showed at Catskill Film Festival in Catskill this weekend on the 3rd and 4th of March, 2nd and 3rd of March. And we are just continuing a live discussion of what we were discussing on the Monday afternoon show, WGXC Monday afternoon show, in which we sort of outlined the history of the film, but then realized that we were getting into more sort of offshoots and intricate detailing of language and history and documentation. And you were at that point, before we had to end, talking about the way in which the Pimon people used song or language or symbolism, all of the above, to attract that which they wanted to bring into their world. Could you talk a little bit more? You left with actually drawing scales on your skin as a way to attract fish.
Yes, well, it's an interesting process. What happened while we were gathering the information in order to piece together the history of the chief, because one thing would lead to another and to another one. It was like being an investigator, you know, a spy of sorts. In the first case, we went to see the old man who was his aide-de-camp, which I talked about, and he told us a story about the chief as he was growing up, what he used to tell him, the stories about his childhood, and how he came back and had his vision and all that. So that took us into the chief's granddaughter, which was the mother of Hortensia, who had lived in the house of the chief. So she told us the story about what it was like to live in that house, in that household. He had five wives, and the house was separated in certain ways so that each wife had her place and the children had their place, and how it was very interesting to find out just what it was like to be with him when he was an adult. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that she said was that he would get up really early in the morning, at 3 in the morning, every morning, and he would sing between 3 and 6 every single day. And the song he sang was called Marik, which is a type of song that is magical. Only the Piasan, who are the shamans of that culture, can sing that song because it has such magical powers that if anybody else does it, he or she can do great harm. So nobody gets to know these songs except the Piasan. So the fact that this man was singing Mariks meant that he was a Piasan. So suddenly we have this very interesting bit of information that changed everything around. Now we were studying a shaman, and we needed to find out more about what these songs were about. What it was that he was doing every morning when he rose at 3 to sing for 3 hours. Why was he doing this? So this took us into this man who had been gathering information. He was younger, but he had been gathering information about the music of the people. And he explained to us what this song and several other types of songs, it's all very, very regimented, very classified, what each kind of music is. And there's social music, and there's magical music, and there's others that are kind of like spells, or really used for protection. They're kind of spells, but they're used for protection and for healing. So the whole idea of, well, let me just say, the first thing we found out that what he was doing is he was singing to the places that he was going to visit in his travels, because he was traveling all the time because he was representing his people, and he actually became the very, very first native Venezuelan to represent his people in government. So he was always traveling, and he would wake up and he would sing to the places where he was going so that he could find the right energy when he went there. Because these songs are about being able to I'm not going to say manipulate, but stimulate.
Sort of, and also adapt to those environments that he's going to go into?
Not that he would adapt, but it would adapt to him. Okay. It was so that the energy was correct when he arrived. So that, because what they believe they can do is they can harmonize. They can maneuver the equilibrium of the place, the energies of the different species, the different natures, the different energies of a place, by singing to it. And a lot of it is in the words, which words they use, how they use them, the sound of the words. So this became, it's just such a beautiful concept to me, such a beautiful concept. Then we were taken to, this man that we were interviewing said, well, you know, I said, can you sing us one of these songs? And he said, I can't sing a song because I'm not a piasan. You have to go to a piasan to sing this song. So he directed us to a piasan. It was actually a woman. And we got there, and it was mind-blowing, the experience of the song that she sang, because she also explained how the song works. I mean, he had explained how the song works, but she explained how that particular song was going to work. And what they do is that the very first part of the song is a kind of salutation to the person who is coming to ask for the song, because that person is doing a service by allowing the person who is going to sing to be able to use her talents to make something happen. So the first thing is a kind of thank you, salutation and thank you to you for coming to us for the services. And then after that, it's an invocation, because what they do is they actually invoke the spirits. Say you're sick and you come here and you say, I'm coming to you because I need to be healed. So she first salutes you and thanks you, and then she invokes a certain spirit to take your spirit with him and go to the place where it's going to be healed, which may be on the top of a mountain or under the water in a river.
And they would sing to that place.
First they have to lure the spirit. They start singing so that the spirit comes. And then they get the spirit to lure the spirit of the person. So I'm singing. I lure the spirit that's in some cave in a mountain. And I lure the spirit to come over here. And then I lure it to lure your spirit out of you and take your spirit out with that spirit and go to the place which you're singing to, so that when they get there, the place is correct. Mm-hmm. And they go into the water, or where they're flying over the mountains. And then that your spirit, which is the one that needs the healing, gets the healing in that place and then has to come back. So what they're saying is, this song is in three parts. And actually the middle part is quite amazing. The middle part, it gets very dark. It gets deep, very, very deep. It's very different from the other two parts. And that's when the spirit is over there, when the spirit is doing the traveling and doing the healing. And when it comes back, then this, they say, you have to be very careful not to even listen to this song if you're not going to continue it to the end, because you'll be left over there, because your spirit is being taken over there too in order to go through the experience of, you know, what the spirits are doing. So you can't listen to it without listening to the end, because then you'll be sick. So I'm always very careful when I'm going to play this song, you know, when I'm editing or something, or showing it to somebody, because I want to listen to the whole song. I don't want my spirit left over there.
I mean, that's one of the most interesting ways of looking at a song. And then when you think about it in terms of modern day distraction and how we never listen to the full intention of an artist by listening to the whole duration of an album. You know, like there's so much intention that people put into specific forms of media.
Or a film.
And we never watch it all.
Yeah.
And that must mean, and to me it makes me think of being disconnected enough to not really understand the effects often of art and what it can do.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah.
But I love that idea of being transported. Because you think about art in terms of its ability to transport.
Absolutely.
But to physically transport by sort of utilizing sound and connecting it to spirit and taking you to alternate places to do the work that we think we can only do. there's something really wonderful.
Exactly. And I felt that the film should be structured in that way, with even, you know, some sort of, you know, when the film is completed, some sort of a warning at the beginning. You must watch the complete film. Otherwise, you may be left somewhere. You know, your spirit may be left somewhere. And then you'll get sick. No, I don't want to do that. But I want to make sure that there's something about the structure of the song that made me think I must incorporate it in the film, because it's also paying homage to the way they construct, which is interesting, because there was a woman there who was a linguist. I mean, she's been trained, you know, outside of the community as a linguist, but she's from Camarata. And she's been working with companies, even in Switzerland, to publish their stories that are fascinating. And she was saying that one of the things that happened to her when she began gathering the stories, she would go back to the elders and say, well, what do you think about this? You know, once she got the gist of a story, and she would put it into words, write it down, go back to them and say, what do you think about this? And they say, uh-uh. And she said, it took her a long time to realize where the problem was, and the problem was structural. Because she said she was using the kind of syntax that we use in Western thinking, which is, once upon a time, there was this and this and that and that. And she said they can't think that way. They think there's a teaching, there's a process, and there's another teaching in the end. And that's how they think. It's a completely different idea.
Could you unpack that a little bit?
I'm not sure that I
can. But when you say that it starts with a teaching, so is that it starts with an assumption, and then there's a process, and then that assumption is either validated or proven to create another lesson?
See, this is one of the things I would like to go deeper into, because it stayed as a question mark in me. I'm not sure I understand. It took her a very long time to understand it. I'm not sure that I understand if the teaching has something to do. Is this two separate teachings? Mm-hmm. She said it begins with a teaching and ends with a teaching. I don't know if the teaching is the same teaching in different words, or if it's a completely different teaching. It has to be. I'm not sure. I need to explore that a little bit more.
But what's so interesting is it seems as if maybe it's incomprehensible to us because it's embedded in a structure that we don't have consciousness of. And that can only be through a cultural, or maybe you could figure it out, but it does seem like you have to
explore more.
Mind bend.
Yeah, exactly. You have to go deeper. That's why I'm not so sure that I can, you know, at this point say that I understand it. I need to go a lot deeper than that in order to even scratch the surface of something like that. If they reject so readily something like, once upon a time there was this and that, then I'm not so sure that I can understand what a teaching means all the way at the beginning like that, you know? Right. I dealt with that, and I realized that I began my film in a way like, once upon a time. I tried to put a teaching into it, but it ended up being a story. Mm-hmm. It's a story about a man who was one of the first Piasan that they always talk about him. And it talks about how there were so many more animals all the way at the beginning of time, and how there were these macaws that ate people, and how this Piasan took them into the caves, in this case of Ariantepui, because it's the biggest mountain of the area where they live. The whole valley is at the foot of Ariantepui, which is the mountain that houses Angel Falls. And they would take them into the caves, and he would bury them in deep holes and then cover the holes with big rocks so the animals couldn't escape. And that's why there are so fewer animals today. And that I begin the film with that, but I'm not sure that's a teaching. In a sense, it must be, but I'm not sure what, you know, exactly what they mean by one teaching in the beginning and one at the end. It's fascinating to me. Something I have to explore.
Is the woman who understands, or who was the first person who planted that idea of a teaching followed by process, then followed by another teaching, is she someone who you have direct access to? Like, you could just ask her, or how would you figure that out?
That's another interesting question. Communication is such an art. And, you know, when I got there, they had no internet, and they didn't know anything about computers, and they didn't have any medical assistance of any kind. They had to go out of the valley, and if they got sick, they had to get in an airplane and pay $150 to get to a city to see a doctor. Mm-hmm. When I came back from the first trip there, I spoke to a cousin of mine who had done a telemedicine system in another part of the jungle with another completely different tribe, because he used to go, he's a doctor, and he used to go there as a kid, and he had a piece of land around there, so he set up an antenna and set up, you know, a way to communicate with these people all the time. So when I came back, I said, you must help these people because they really can't afford to live the way they do, and they're really in bad shape, and you have to help me get this done. And he said, I can't. Don't ask me. I can't. I don't have the time or the money. I can't do this. And by the time, you know, when I came back the next time, he said, I have good news for you. I can do this. Somebody has approached me and has provided me the money, and I'm going to be able to do this. Today, they have two doctors and two dentists stationed there all the time.
Wow.
They have internet. They have computers. They have education through the computers. And this is all happening because the movie went there, it started to be made, and all these things happened. And so many more things like that you can't even begin to understand how the magic of these things happened. So today, I can communicate with them by email. They have blogs, they have websites. I suddenly get an email from them, you know, all kinds of things. But still, communication is an art. Sometimes, I just got an email from Hortensia the other day, and she asked me when I'm coming back. I sent her a photograph. I said a lot of things, but I didn't say when I'm coming back. I said, you know, as soon as I can, but I don't know when. It's not that easy to get there.
Yeah.
I haven't heard back from her. Communication isn't so easy, you know. It's like, it's an art. And this woman, she's accessible, but how could I possibly begin to explore that question from so far away and through emails or something like that? You know, it's not something, even when I go there, I would have to make a point to plan the trip in order to do that part of it, to get it done, which I will, but there's so many other things that need to be done too. So yes, of course, it's possible.
But the one thing that I think makes me very excited about this project in particular is the word experimental. So the objective is to document a history that would go into extinction or not necessarily unfold in its full potential without that information being sent down to the next generations. But the reason why experimental resonates really well with me is that if it was just a documentary, then you could document the experiences of others and try to get it historically accurate. And a really good documentary does make you see things differently. But in this one, it's deeper than that because it's about giving voice or visual attention to or documenting a alternate mode of perception, and that can only be done so in the act of documenting you are transforming someone's or giving someone an alternate way of perceiving. And to do that just puts documentary into such a challenging category but also such a exciting one.
I'm so glad you're saying that because it is the crux of what I'm doing. I had to make a choice, and of course I'm an artist, so for me, the most important thing is the experience. And going there has changed me so completely that I needed to communicate that more than anything else because this is who they are. So for me, the most important thing, it isn't to document something about them. It is to take what I experience as who they are as people and somehow express it in some way in which other people, like yourself, can experience it too. And that's what it's about. And it's very difficult to maintain that vision because it's very easy to just say, oh, I'm just gonna, oh look, this is happening, like the doctor's coming in, or the way they react to something that's going on, or Hortensia became a chief in the process, or it could become political, it could become activist, it can become all kinds of other things, but I have to keep my focus in the experience.
Right.
The experience of being in that place, of being a Kamarakoto, of going through the process of unveiling this knowledge that is coming out of the experience of meeting these old people and being able to access the documentation from outside and putting it all together, and this kind of puzzle that begins to appear, mm-hmm. you know, as you move forward, and wow.
It makes me think maybe that where we were talking about before, a lesson, process, lesson. So if, for instance, you have a lesson or you have a statement and then you put it through a process or you put it through an experience, the way that you just outlined the experience, and then you state the lesson again, you could never hear it
the same way. Uh-huh. That's interesting.
And so it shows you what time is. If you start one place and then you have an experience and you try to return to that place, you never could.
That's very interesting.
And I wonder if that's something.
That's very beautiful. Yeah, that's food for thought. Thank you.
Yeah, but I love it. I mean, just in terms for me, it's like the moment someone gives you a kernel of an alternate way of thinking, I think that can provide so much growth in just a short amount of time because your mind expands because you don't have things to hold on to anymore. And so that could be such a valuable film.
Absolutely. And that also happens when you go to that place, because there's something so grandiose about it, so kind of out of proportion to anything that you're used to experiencing. You feel so small. You feel so there's the sense of the sublime. I never understood the sense of the sublime before I was there. But there's also, at the same time as feeling so small, you also feel so big, because for the first time you really feel like you're a part of the earth and a part of nature in an intricate way in which you really are, but you never experienced. Because this is the first time I understood that we think of nature as if it's something over there. Oh, I'm going to nature. I'm going to visit nature. I'm going to take a walk in nature. What? You're in nature all the time. You can't escape nature, you know? It's like it's a very funny thing when you think about it. And that we think that everything, you know, everything we do has no repercussion. Every tiny little thing we do has all kinds of effects. Yeah. And we forget. We think that we can go around, throw something here and there and move around, and it doesn't matter. Nobody's watching. Nobody's feeling anything. We're not making any marks in the universe. It's not the way it is. Every tiny little thing we do has an effect. And when you're there, you understand it. Why? Because they are so incredibly aware of everything. They do not move a stone without asking permission.
Really?
They ask permission of the stone. Can I please take you out of where you are? If they're going to make clay things, which they make gorgeous ceramics, they go to a place where they get their clay and they bring an offering. Hmm. They do not take something without giving back, ever. They will take the clay out and they will give an offering, even if it's their own clothes, food, anything, something that the earth may not need, but we never know what the earth needs or doesn't need anyway. But they bring an offering. And they understand that they can't, and it's a very Buddhist kind of idea of living. They say, for example, if you go into the caves, and of course the caves are filled with spirits, you go into the caves, if you see a flower and you think, I want to take it home, you're immediately vulnerable for the spirits to take your spirit away, because you have desired something. You have desired to take it home instead of just respecting it and say, what a beautiful flower, and leaving it where it is. But just the thought of it, just the emotion of wanting to take it,
is
already a kind of lack of respect for just where it is and what it is.
But what's so interesting also from like an artistic perspective, it's very often to look at that flower and say, what can I do with it?
Exactly.
Like what form could I put that flower in to make it more enjoyable?
To please me.
Yeah. Instead of the opposite of that, being like the form is perfect in and of itself. It has an ecosystem. It grew out of its own volition. And that's the art.
And I'm enjoying it where it is, as it is. Yes. It's fascinating.
There's just so many. Every single time you look at the way they do it, you immediately compare it to maybe how you were raised or how you think to do it. And then it makes you question, like, everything.
I know. When they say they get sick and they bring in the shaman, and the shaman will do, you know, these different songs to heal you, but he'll also teach you the right way, because they say that you only get sick because you're doing things the wrong way, because your behavior is incorrect. So they'll say, the woman is pregnant and she gets out of the hammock and leaves her covers all wrapped around like that in the hammock, and then she expects the placenta to come out. It's just so amazing, you know, like, wow. The correct way to do it, of course, is the woman gets up, folds the blankets, puts them in the cover, and then leaves the place, and the hammock stays clean. Mm-hmm. And that's correct behavior. But we don't think that if we don't do things the correct way, we're going to get sick. And then we wonder why we get sick. It's just so beautiful. They feel, for example, they don't throw a stone into the puddle, into the pond, because they're irritating the god of water. So what? And then they wonder why a storm comes. It's because you've irritated it.
The ripple effect.
The ripple effect, exactly. So much to learn from people who are still in touch with the essence of living, you know?
So you have 80 hours of footage that, I mean, you have probably an exorbitant amount of footage,
exorbitant,
but you have to cull it down, or you have to bring
to
it 80 down
minutes.
To 80 minutes. And I understand, like, what I thought was so interesting was just this sense of responsibility when you have all of this information, and information is the wrong word as well. Because when you have all of this experience and it's your job or your responsibility maybe to try to somehow translate it in a way that would bring these things that you're outlining here to people's attention, do you feel like film is enough? Do you feel like there's any other medium that in your experience could give clear translation?
I think film is very complete as a medium because it involves writing, it involves music, it involves sound, it involves visuals, it involves performance.
To the point where you can get an atmosphere.
Yes, I think it's the most complete medium, and that's why I chose it, because I had to choose between writing and photography, and I ended up choosing film. Yes, it has all of it, in and I think it's, you know, of all the things I can do, I think this is the better one. But it's about transmitting the experience is how I feel it has to be. And I have to go into the next part is introducing Jimmy Angel and his whole history, which is harder to introduce than Ruth Robertson, which came organically because of the photographs.
Right.
So I have to introduce his history. And then once I establish, it's the same. Imagine that. The kind of challenge of making the film is the same as the challenge of having to get the information from the elders, because I have to introduce the explorers in the film without getting out of the place and the sense of it before I go into the interviews, because you have to know as the audience who Jimmy Angel is and who Ruth Robertson is and what was going on there.
Right.
Before you get into, because they're going to be talking about it and you can't, I don't want to stop. It's very important for me to, you know, in terms of structure of film, syntax of film, when I get into a space, I don't want to come out of it.
Yeah.
I don't want to have pieces of interviews that interchange with different subject matters. You know, I want go into a place, and you will see when I do the cut of the interviews that the interviews take up what's going on around the people. They're in their huts, and you know the weather is changing, and the kids are running around, and the dogs are and the chickens, and everything is happening around them, and that's part of the interview. Mm-hmm. So once I go into a space, I want to stay there until I finish, and then come out and get into the truck and go to the other space. It's like a road movie, in a sense. You go here, you go there, you go. In always, it's kind of like in a sense a linear story, and that says everything else is unlinear. But that
it also feels like you're making little songs.
Little songs, yeah. That's nice. It's a very nice thing. And there's going to be a lot of music in the film. And so once I have the interviews, then I can move forward into the kind of overall quality of the film that is going to also have an element of self-deconstruction, because mm-hmm. Hortensia is going to get involved in the making of the film, which is what actually happened. Because I have already what you saw, I also have it with her voice in Spanish. And I eventually want to have it with her voice in English. That's why I said at the end, I don't know if you noticed, temporary voiceover with Isabel Barden, because I did them just so that I could have something, but I want her, her voice is beautiful.
Yeah, but so is yours in that film.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's very different from hers. There's just so much matter of fact and kind of warm.
But you know, it almost would be really fantastic to have her do it, just because if she does hold in her language structure any form of alternate modes of perceiving,
mm-hmm.
then kind of in the same way like in your film where you showed a picture of Jimmy Angel to the old lady in the hammock, and you watched her see that picture maybe for the first time, it brought up the question, by giving her the documentation, she then can relive the history and therefore bring information up that maybe she wouldn't have come to had you just said his name. And so there's these the way that visual language can work in the same way that her language can work. Like if she says a sentence formation, or you know, if she says the word spirit in a way that sounds different, it can just make the mind
go somewhere else. Yeah, absolutely.
And so then it becomes about what is the power of documenting. Like you don't even know what its capabilities are, but you put some visual language together, you put a sentence structure together, a string of words, and it'll do something.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's a whole other thing. I mean, I'm not sure that I can go there with this film. She will do it also in Pemón, because it's going to be, you know, primarily this is for them to have their own history. That's number one. So this is going to be done in Pemón, and I have no idea, you know, I never know what it is that they're talking about when I'm filming them. I would never know what she's saying. I'll do the voiceovers and do the technical part, but she'll say whatever she wants to say. So we'll never know. But it's all fascinating from that point of view. But in the end, what, you know, when I came back, because I come home with all this information, and then I sit with my computer, and actually the writing comes later, because the voiceover, the whole film, by the way, for the people who are listening, is a voiceover. It's like a letter to the world from Hortensia, or a letter to her people. So the voiceovers have to be written, but they really come from my talking to her. I mean, I have lots and lots of hours of just asking her questions just with a microphone, and she answering and telling me all kinds of stories. And so from there, and from the sessions with the film that we've shot, that's where the voiceovers come from. But I have to put them together.
Right.
I have to write them. So I start editing, and I start writing for the edit and edit for the writing. I mean, it's a kind of like it's happening at the same time. But when I go back there and I say, Hortensia, what do you think? This is what I came up with. You have to approve it and tell me if I did this correctly, if this is really how you would say it, and if this is really the truth of what we got out of the interviews.
Okay.
And then, you know, at this point, she was happy with everything. She didn't change anything except one spelling of the word Piazan that I had gotten wrong. But other than that, she was happy with it. And I was, of course, very happy with that. But it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work and a lot of careful work.
Well, I can't wait to see what happens.
Yeah, me neither.
So you're deep into, you're deep in the process.
Very, very. I want to get back into it. I mean, I need to move forward, and I've taken a break from it, and you know, it got very, very intense.
Yeah.
As you could hear from the stories about bringing the medicine and the computers and all that stuff. I mean, there's no way that you can come and get involved in the lives of people like this and not become involved in a much deeper way than just making a movie.
Right.
There's just no way that you can do this, but it can get a little bit too much, and it was difficult to kind of like start separating and saying, well, I can go only this far here and I can only go this far. So I had to take a step back. I've done that, and now I'm ready to get back into it.
I mean, I just think what's interesting from a journalistic perspective is, and then also coupling it with the need to ask. A journalist often just asserts himself and tries to cover a story without asking whether or not he's welcome, or even so far as, you know, on a spiritual level, asking, you know? And
absolutely.
It's that question of asking when it comes to documenting or making art, especially from the viewpoint of how you just outlined it, I think is really interesting to think about.
Yeah, it's more like being asked to help, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, seeing a need and saying, well, I'm here. If you want it or need it, and being asked, yes, please come, you know. And then going through a family history, a family tree, and saying, okay, who are the people, you know, who are the people who would make a difference in this story? Who are the people who really, in the whole community, who are the people who really know? And then sitting down and asking, what would we ask each person, you know? What would this interview be about? It's a fascinating thing. It's a fascinating process. It really is. There was one moment in the making of, in the shooting of the film, that was particularly fascinating. And it was, Hortensia and I went to interview the man who was designated by Alejo Calcaño to be his successor. Actually, he was the second person that he designated, because the first one died before him. So this was kind of a second choice, and it was his son, his youngest son.
Mm-hmm.
And this man had forever not been satisfied with his life, because he felt that he was given this command or mission in life that he was going to, at some point, find the right time to disclose the secrets of these teachings to the new generations. And he had never found the time. He had never found the time to do it, or the opportunity to do it.
Hmm.
And Hortensia, during this interview, seized the opportunity. She saw it, and she said, my great-grandfather used to say that there were going to be these things coming in the future. There were going to be telephones that you could see the people talking on the other side. There were going to be airplanes that were manned by just one person. They would be all these different things that have come true. And I'm saying that the moment is now, and that this is the generation, that this is the moment in which you have to pass the teachings down. And I'm asking you to do it with me. I'm asking you to give me the teachings of my great-grandfather. And I was amazed by that. When she and I walked out of that interview, we were elated, because we had understood that moment, when the two generations, the elders and the young people, had created that gap, and they seemed to be stretching out, and they were never going to meet. And the moment was now, and it was being seized. And this was the time. This was the bridge.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is you're making me think of The Giver. It's a little bit different in nature, but it's a book about a community that has lost. Basically, they thought that if you just systematized everything and took culture out, that you would be you would have more productivity. And there was no color, there was no ability to really sense per se. And so there was this one man called the Giver who housed all of the emotional structures. He housed the sensation of snow. He housed, like, because even the weather was regulated. They regulated the weather. They regulated everything. And so the book chronicles the time when the Giver was about to leave and he needed to find the generation that could then house all the emotions uh-huh. of that community. And so one by one, the Giver gives him an experience and the kid has to sit and experience something that he's never had before. Uh-huh. And as he experiences stuff, he then he's got the sensation of snow. He's got the sensation of anger and tears and all the things that we take for granted. And he goes back into his community and tries to live normally and realizes that by him having these experiences and no one else having them, that he no longer can communicate.
Uh-huh.
And so then his notion of language, because it's more saturated with experience, then doesn't equate or equal up with his friends and even his mom and dad. And so it's this beautiful book that a lot of people are required to read in school. There's a part that makes me now realize that a lot of what is happening in your film is what maybe the Giver is trying to articulate.
How interesting. That is very interesting. It's fascinating because I was saying after the film, it's kind of like waiting for the Messiah. You know, you're waiting for that moment when something is going to come, or the moment is going to come where you're going to be able to, in a sense, the generation of the kids are waiting for the moment in which the teachings are going to be given to them, and the generation of the elders is waiting for the time when they can give the teachings away. And so, it's not happening, and suddenly something happens.
Right.
And it's that key that I was saying before, you know, it's like when the moment when something, there's a bridge, there's the place where this one can come this way and that one can come that way and they can meet. But you always need a facilitator. That's the Giver. You always need something, or maybe that's the child, right?
Mm-hmm.
You always need the person who is the carrier to be able to, like, you know, in this case, it's Hortensia. But I was amazed because that's actually on video. That's the moment at which she seizes the moment and says, wait a second. You're saying that you haven't been able to find the person? It's me. It's mm-hmm. now. We are the people. We are the generation. The time is now. That is so incredibly beautiful.
To me, it just highlights that notion of asking. But it also, it makes you kind of question when someone gives you a piece of information without the experience. When you just start taking in information all the time and you don't get to process it. Or you're not ready for it. Yeah. And maybe that's the difference between information and understanding.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Because when you understand with your whole body, and with information, you just kind of conceptually take it in.
Yeah, you take it in with your mind instead of with your whole being. Yeah, absolutely.
Huh.
Yeah. Thank you. This film has to be finished.
Isabel, thank you so much for talking to me. I'm very excited to see what happens.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.